A new series of discussions about the state of the arts in 2022, including issues of equity, programming, audience engagement, funding, and working as independent artists, will be taking place beginning this Wednesday. Listening to the field, artists and arts leaders discuss what's happened and what next happens. Wednesdays, January 26th, February 16th, March 23rd, and April 6th at 7 p.m. Those events will be online and facilitated by David Snyder, who is a lecturer in the Arts Administration Program at Skidmore College, Executive and Artistic Director of Hubbard Hall in Cambridge, New York, and author of the new professional playbook, Managing Arts Organizations. And it's a great pleasure to welcome David Snyder back to the roundtable. How are you, sir?
I'm well, Joe. How are you? Great to be with you.
So great to be with you, and I thank you very much for the time and for the great work you're doing here. So let us talk about the series, and then we'll get into the book and obviously what you're all about here. But I assume that some of this, yes, because we think about this as, what are arts organizations doing as a result of the pandemic? But
right. This
work has been dealing with these issues and working on many of these issues for a long time prior to that of managing arts organizations and what ultimately needs to happen next.
Right. So, a lot of this is about sort of, the build back better sense of like, how do we rebuild arts organizations or come back to audiences with things that we should have been working on for a long time, including equity and diversity and how our financial models work. And so it just felt like a golden time to check in with leaders across the country in many different arts disciplines about what they're doing about all this, what they've learned, what the moment of the last 2 years has taught them, and how they're coming back in the spring and summer, before we get back to any kind of new normal. How are they building and rebuilding now?
So when it came to this series, obviously you've written a book on it, and we'll talk about that in a second, but when it came to the series, who ultimately did you want to talk to and have discussions with to flesh out some of these topics?
So I'm talking to, this week, Donna Walker-Kuhn, who's one of the major national leaders in audience engagement, people like Chad Bauman, who leads Milwaukee Rep out in Wisconsin. In February, we'll talk to artists who are independent artists but also work with organizations, and so thinking about what's that relationship between artists and organizations. Many different leaders across multiple disciplines. One of the best things about writing the book that I experienced last year was in the book I include a chapter called Listening to the Field, in which I got to talk to 11 arts leaders around the country about all these issues, and so I learned it's very interesting to think about how does a museum approach this work, how does a performing arts center approach this work, how does a dance company? And looking at all those different perspectives can really help illuminate issues of equity, financial models, arts ecologies, how things are changing writ large and how they're changing like on the micro level at each organization.
It's funny because the perception often is those in the arts are very progressive. So why do you think that this pursuit of equity in many states of a state of the arts has been so difficult to achieve?
Well, I think it's one of those things where you have a tension between, obviously, finance, pursuing donors, pursuing subscriptions. There was a great study put out by SMU Data Arts at Southern Methodist University last spring, April 2021, intersection of marketing and finance and equity, that talked about how subscription bases can push against diversity because you're really paying attention to largely older white subscribers who are providing a lot of the financing for larger organizations. And so there are certain tensions, even in the business models of arts organizations, that push against and challenge these. You also have long-term donors who may take umbrage at the idea of something being systemically racist and say, we're not racist, and not really taking on the sense that there is systemic racism in all of this, and how do we uproot that? But also looking at, talking to people like Lisa Richards-Tony, who runs the Association of Performing Arts Professionals, Ben Cameron at the Jerome Foundation in Minneapolis, thinking about like how do funders look at this? How is the funding ecology changing? And how are presenters thinking about this versus producers?
Have you found, while you were researching the book, were you surprised by the state of things? I mean, I think the pandemic has certainly laid a lot bare And I think we've seen that in, obviously we've seen it on Broadway, we've seen it in the film industry, we've seen it in the music industry. So do you see it as well that it allowed that pause, if you will, allowed the cracks to really show?
Yeah, and things like, there's a case that I include in the book from the Indianapolis Museum of Art that happened just last February and March, where even last February they listed for a new executive director, and part of that listing included language that said that they wanted to retain their largely white audience. And you kind of go, wow, even in spring of 2021, people are tripping over these issues. And so it gave us a bit of a moment this last 2 years to kind of go, how do we function? How have we sort of adopted sort of a corporate America thought in all of these arts organizations? How do we undo that? How do we grapple with that? But the book really is aimed at giving everybody a playbook for how do the arts work in the United States right now across all these disciplines? How do you raise money for the arts? How do you manage people in the arts? And how do arts managers become even better managers when they think about what are their core values, what are their core principles, and how can those inform everything that they do as arts leaders?
How do you look at the corporate America model? Is that good or bad for arts organizations?
Well, it's been challenging. I think the last 50 or 60 years, the arts took on the corporate model because we thought, oh, we've got to be a business. You know, we've got to get our stuff in line. We've got to build buildings. And so we sort of adopted a corporate business model in a lot of larger arts organizations without going, well, there's kind of a poison pill as the drive of capitalism in that. And so we have to be not just adopting business practices of corporate America, but kind of going, we're more creative than that. We can recreate this model. We can do better than that. So I think we're in a sort of second phase of regional arts in the United States where we can kind of go, we're really good at business, but frankly, people who have MFAs and are creators are even better at business because we innovate. We imagine. We can create new ways of doing this business, and we should be doing that. I think more and more we see corporate America actually adopting creative America more and more, and we should be embracing that.
I know one of the conversations that you're going to have is about adaptation and evolution, which brings this issue of how much change do audiences want and of their arts facility, and how much do you think is necessary for many of these issues to be addressed?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a lot of, we're in this sort of moment of dynamic disruption, which means that we can be using online digital strategies a lot better. We can be saying, we're changing how we're programming. I think there's a hunger for change because we, as a people, are much less tied to going just to a large building and being in one location. We want sort of everything in our pocket now. And there's a certain amount of going to a live performing arts event is always going to be invaluable and so cherished. But also there's an ability for arts organizations to sort of flow through people's lives in a more seamless way and not be so sort of hierarchical that we can kind of go, you have to come here now at this set time, and that's the only way you can connect with us. So I think it's also just we have generations. My kids are certainly digital natives. With the pandemic, they've gotten pushed more and more online. And so this is also a moment where we kind of know generations are coming up that are going to need to be digitally engaged and not just brought to these larger buildings. And the letting go of sort of larger costs of buildings and infrastructure also lets arts organizations collaborate better and work better and hopefully drive more money directly to artists and arts programming, because that's been a challenge too. Part of equity is just going, can we pay everybody? Can we pay everybody better? Can we pay everybody equitably? Because no matter what, people are not getting paid well enough in the arts and still doing too many unpaid internships, and the entry levels are just not fair enough.
How do you look at technology as far as when the pandemic happened, a lot of arts organizations went to Zoom events because they had to. They wanted to do something. And how much of that technology will hold over, do you think? And how much of it is just a snapshot of what we were going through during the pandemic? And then, look, people want to be out and go to an actual place and be in a room with other people to experience art.
Yeah, I mean, I think the comparative advantage is always going to be the live event, because we can get many different things streaming in many different ways and better ways that we have in our homes and on our screens now. La Placa Cohen, that's a consulting firm in New York City, last year did a survey called the Community Culture and Community in the Time of Crisis, and they looked at digital streaming events and found that only 11% of audiences were paying or willing to pay anything for a digital stream from arts organizations. And the latest survey they did this year looked again at the idea that any digital from arts organizations really needed to be free to engage people. So I don't know it's ever going to be an income stream, which means it's probably going to be auxiliary, but there's probably a beta version of all this where we go, okay, post-pandemic, how do we really stream in innovative ways that are exciting and helpful? Like Second Stage Theater in New York just did a new Lynn Nottage play that I actually got to see live on Broadway in early December, but they also streamed it. It was called Clyde's.
Right.
And they streamed it for anybody who didn't want to or couldn't get into the theater. And I think that was a glimmer of like, oh, that streaming happened on a limited basis while it was also live on Broadway. And that was really popular and useful because people could see that great new Lynn Nottage play on their screens. And so it's almost like as better quality and better access comes digitally to the main event in the arts, that digital streaming of that live event may prove really valuable.
And there will be a choice, and that choice is beneficial to the audience, but also beneficial to the performers as well.
Yeah, and it gets the work out there. It reaches people worldwide, as we know. It just provides greater access. I think one of the things that La Placa Cohen found last year, too, was that even though the watching of digital streaming was limited, there was a certain sector of people of color who attended orchestra events, music events online that had not attended a live event in that milieu over the last 2 years. So it also provided access to audiences that may not want to go to those live events, but also would access them digitally.
Certainly, this is not a criticism at all of what you are doing. It's just a question as to, you know, one of the things that you're doing in the series is discussing what has happened and what happens next. We don't really know, do we? I mean, every conversation I'm on, whether it be a Zoom conversation, okay, well, what do we do next? We have no idea.
That's something that we all cop to and will cop to in these conversations is kind of going, we're in the midst of history, so we're not writing the history books right now. But we're trying to capture a moment and also in these conversations just get these amazing arts leaders to say, what do you predict? What do you know? What do you not know? What are the unknowns going into 2022 for the arts? What might you think might happen in the next year? The Wallace Foundation last year put out a scenario toolkit for the arts that was really helpful in terms of it laid out 4 scenarios for the arts to help us think as arts leaders about, well, if this happens, then that happens. And one of the 4 scenarios that was one of the darkest ones is, well, the arts reopen, big reopening, you know, in 2021, and then there's another wave of the virus, and we shudder again. And so we are living through what they sort of laid out as one of the worst-case scenarios right now. You know, the SVOG funding has come and gone. So 2022, 2023 is really where the rubber's going to start hitting the road in the arts. And so it's an important moment to kind of gauge and record, like, where are we? Where are we in our thinking? What do we think might happen? And how can we collaborate across all these disciplines and across the country to help each other?
So let me ask you directly, as an arts administrator for Hubbard Hall in Cambridge, New York, what do you make of the next 12 months of what it will be like for your institution?
So we're starting to come back in terms of performances. I mean, we were lucky that we're such a small scale at Hubbard Hall that we were able to come back with classes and performances at a limited basis pretty quickly in 2020. But we are, like a lot of smart organizations, I think, holding on to any money that we have in the bank, knowing that we are looking at maybe a 2-year period again of being pretty dry. We're not going to get the federal funding that we got last year. We benefited from SVOG. Donors have stepped up for us, but the box office is going to continue to be small. We're going to do chamber music this summer, but we'll probably do very limited performances or presentations in the fall. So we're still on sort of another 2-year cycle of really recovering back to regular activity. So I think at the time, like I'm thinking, I know Chad at Milwaukee Rep is thinking, like if you have any money in the bank, hold on to it because we're going to have a dry period here the next year or two where we're really not going to bring in enough income from ticket fees and events in order to pay the bills. So we got to stretch things out.
Unfortunately, in 30 seconds that we have left, where does that leave audiences in the meantime? Where do they go?
Well, I think they're online, and I also think they can come in and engage with everything that we're doing and with other organizations that are doing in small ways. And so it's a matter of like staying in touch. We're always e-blasting what we're doing next, engaging people. So we have, you know, we have performances coming up in April already. We have classes starting in February. So I think it's just a matter of arts organizations and audiences have to be talking more and more so that we're aware of when things are happening, how it can happen, and how we get them in there.
Listening to The Field, artists and arts leaders discuss what's happened and what happens next. It happens Wednesdays, the first one January 26th, then February 16th, March 23rd, and April 6th. You can find out more at hubbardhall.org. David's new book is Managing Arts Organizations. David, thanks so much.
Thanks so much, Joe. I really appreciate it.
Appreciate you as well. Thank you. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.